Well, thank you. Yeah. But I think this is the thing, is that those same reasons that I was like stubbornly bearish when everyone wanted me to be bullish, now right. I'm bullish, and people are like, well, Rory, the price is not really cooperating with your thesis. I'm like, well, that's fine. I agree. That's weird. No doubt. Yeah. I've been wrong on the price relationship. That, I think, is manifest in the market. Doesn't change the fact that we're drawing down physical volumes at record rates. So it's going to be really funny. There's always this, like, people are like, oh, well, the fundamentals will win out. I agree. Right. The fundamentals always win out. It's, you know, 3 months ago, the fundamentals were insanely bearish. And now they're more bullish than they have been at any point in my career to date.
Rory Johnston, Commodity Context. Good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Thanks for coming on. So I've been an admirer for a little while here, and you have an interesting perspective, but let's start with what it is just, correct me if I'm wrong, your perspective is just oil's being mispriced, or it was mispriced on the lower end of that. Tell me, work that out, lower end of the price curve of where it's been at. Talk to me a little bit about that, and talk to me about where oil was pre-Middle Eastern conflict that we just had.
Yeah, so today we're sitting just shy of $60 on Brent crude, the global benchmark. That is high relative to our past couple of years, but obviously low relative to where I had expected us to be 3 months into a war with Iran and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. We're now going on well over a billion barrels of oil lost to the market. But I think that there are fundamental reasons that we can point to, that we can use to explain the lack of price increase. But I think even with those explanations, you still come to the conclusion that the market is being atypically sanguine, let's say, that normally the oil market, if anything, overreacts to geopolitical risk. I have frequently criticized the oil market and pricing for this, that most geopolitical risks do not manifest into actual supply shocks. Like the lion's share just fizzle out with nothing else. So it's usually a pretty good bet to sell oil on these geopolitical spikes. It doesn't typically change the durable direction that much. Hormuz is different.
That's exactly it. I'm interrupting you. That's a great, great point. I'm glad you made that. Go ahead.
Thanks. I think whereas in, that's a great point. You know, whereas this crisis, we have fundamentally already lost. We have already lost the supply, right? This is something that we know we have 13 to 15 million barrels a day of oil production in the Gulf currently offline. We're accumulating record deficits in the market here. Like we've never seen deficits of this size in the market. But I think it's important to understand, to try and appreciate some of the reasons that, you know, you can explain some of the price underreaction relative to our expectations, to kind of separate what is explainable from what's not. I think it's important to kind of start with before the war, and you had kind of asked how this differs from before the war. Before the war, we had been in a protracted surplus in the market. This was something that, largely due to OPEC's reintroduction of large volumes of previously withheld crude to the market, OPEC had swamped the market. Now, OPEC itself had tried to hold the market artificially high by cutting off this massive amounts of oil in what were at that moment pretty non-emergency conditions. But overall, that needed to be unwound, and that's basically what happened. So now, then you had demand was fine, but non-OPEC supply growth was already growing faster than demand was. And then OPEC was adding huge volumes of supply on top of that. We had been building, prior to the war, over the prior year, we had been building stocks on average of upwards of 2 million barrels a day. That's a lot of oil that was being pumped into the system. I think absent the war, we would very clearly be, you know, in the 50s on Brent at this stage, possibly even lower. That was the direction of travel for the market. But all of a sudden, Hormuz changed all of that. Basically that, you know, we have already eroded the entirety of the of that stock surplus that we had accumulated over the prior year. We basically did away with that in months. all of the oil and water that had built up, Iranian, Russian, et cetera, that was all drained down in a record amount of time. We have these massive stockpiles, but we're draining them down faster than we've ever drained down stocks in the history of the oil market. But I think even then, it's interesting to note that we're even draining them down at the fastest rate in the history of the market, we're still draining them down slower than we would have otherwise expected going into this crisis. And the biggest swing that I, and I would argue many other oil analysts, did not appreciate the scale of is what we've seen in China. And that China has reduced crude oil exports by something like 5 million barrels a day relative to February levels to today. Now, even if you assume that some of February levels were stock building, which objectively it was, you're seeing like a 4 million barrel a day swing in realized demand. Now, people are pointing that and saying it's demand destruction. Then we go down the chain. We're like, okay, yeah, you know, imports are down huge. Refinery runs are down, but not as much as imports. So that's weird. You must be getting some crude from somewhere else because we're not seeing it in inventory draws. And then on the refined product side, like the actual consumption side, we're not seeing a massive revision or a massive downturn in vehicle fleet traffic, flights, you know, congestion in cities, all of these indicators we became very familiar with during COVID as we were attempting to kind of handicap and follow the return of activity in the world coming out of lockdowns. This is similar, except we're tracking it the opposite direction. Now we're tracking to see if there is going to be lockdown equivalent mobility declines, which is what you'd expect with wide scale demand destruction, but we're not seeing that. So all this together likely means that we're seeing crude inventory, like SPR drawdowns in China that we can't see the flow right out, but we can kind of see what it's doing in the market. Same with refined products. And then the one piece that we could actually be seeing some demand destruction is in the pet chem sector, the petrochemical space. China has heavily swung towards consumer fuels and away from industrial feedstocks. This is the kind of thing that, you know, it shifts that kind of calamity into another supply chain more quick, or have more heavily weights in that direction. So we're still accumulating more and more debt in pet chem that we're going to have to deal with later, but it's saving us a little bit on jet fuel, diesel, gasoline, et cetera. So I think all in all, we're in this state where we are in a historic crisis. There is literally no debate about that at this stage. Anyone that claims like, oh, this proves that we didn't need Hormuz doesn't understand the market they're looking at. But we have had more buffer time, more room in the market, which has allowed two things to happen. First, it's allowed Trump to drag this out longer than I would have imagined he would have ever dragged it out previously. I think if we had crude at 150, 200 bucks, I think he would have found a way to concede ground to the Iranians and reopen the strait much quicker. But the fact that we haven't seen prices that high has removed that pressure. The other thing is that in this weird kind of like limbo time, particularly following a lot of alarmed analysts, myself included at the beginning, being like, this is going to end the world. And clearly, 3 months later, the world has not ended. Equity markets are at near all-time highs. I can't even check this morning, but maybe they're still at the latest all-time high. And nothing seems to be breaking yet. We're seeing the signs of it in the data. Things are breaking. But the market is taking its time because of those buffers and those stocks. The pure, true kind of scarcity panic hasn't hit yet. But it's still coming. And I think that that delay in market panic has both, one, given the White House more time, which is, again, time is inventory here, basically, as we're drawing down. And the other thing is it's allowed the market to kind of convince itself that this isn't as big a deal, that there's an element of price drives narrative here, and that people are like, why is oil at 100 bucks? It should be much higher. And then they go and they're like, okay, well, maybe there's this, and maybe there's this, and you start overweighting things that, yeah, these things do help, but they still don't explain. Like, if you were in any other market with any other president, likely, because again, the unprecedented degree of jawboning and verbal intervention in this market has spiked volatility and has made it very difficult for traders to price that kind of forward risk higher. But all this together has left us in a very, very weird market. And while even the China stuff is helping, and I think is arguably now the single largest kind of strategic swing in the market that is helping stave off disaster faster, We are still drawing down those stocks. And as this continues, even with those more charitable assumptions of heavier buffers, we still run aground pretty quickly here through the summer. And, you know, maybe today there was a latest Axios headline that there was some kind of deal that we were on the verge of concluding. But then it was like, oh, well, everyone's agreed except Trump. Like, well, that feels kind of like a big deal. And then there were separate reports afterwards. It's like, oh, also the Ayatollah hasn't, you know, the Supreme Leader hasn't signed off. It's like, okay, so everyone's agreed except for the two people that actually need to agree at the end of the day. And this is this thing we keep going over right? and over and over again. It's Lucy and the football, it's Groundhog Day, all wrapped into one.
So a lot of questions on that. I want to pull on China because that's interesting to me. And I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. China stopped importing 5 million barrels for 4 million barrels, correct?
Correct.
Why? Is it because their economy slows? It's fallen off a cliff? Or is it because they're getting it for somebody somewhere else?
Well, I think this is the thing. Is my argument is that if it was demand destruction, we would expect to see it in other data. Flights,
right.
Mobility data, traffic. And we're not seeing it.
Right.
So that tells me that we're getting
exactly.
supply from somewhere else. It's coming from stockpiles. It's coming from areas that we can't see. And one of the dirty secrets of the oil market is that while we, relative to a decade ago, when I was still new in this market, we have unprecedented visibility in this market because of firms like Kepler and others that provide tanker tracking, that provide satellite mm-hmm. imagery for crude tanks, et cetera. We have an unprecedented degree of visibility in this market. But we don't have complete visibility in this market. And I think this crisis is really highlighting some of the areas that we still have. There are still big kind of, you know, blind spots for us. Underground Chinese mm-hmm. SPR storage. Most refined product storage. We have good visibility on crude because they typically have floating storage tanks. The roof floats. So you can see how much is in them via satellite. The problem is that gasoline, diesel, et cetera, mm-hmm. typically isn't stored in external floating roof tanks, so you can't see them. So you have to rely on government data to get an estimate of those inventories, and China doesn't publish data on product inventories. So again, these blind spots have been really highlighted for us as a market.
Right. Okay, so then really the next question that I would have is, okay, I believe, and I'm not speaking for you or anybody else, only for myself. I think oil was fundamentally mispriced, and I say mispriced because of data, pre-war. I think it's been mispriced during and after the war. On the other side, but my guess, really, my question, and that's just my, these are just, again, my, but my question really is what is true? Because I hear we got all, the market's going to be flooded with oil because et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I also get this data or these listening to analysts such as yourselves. And I'm in this camp as well, is that the oil markets are actually really tight. I guess my question is what is what an investor like myself, who's an accredited investor, very interested in oil, what do we believe? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's very reasonable. I think here, let's self-ascribe here. I was in the camp of analysts that saw a very sizable glut. That you know, prior to the war, I saw a lot more supply in the market.
Yeah, where did that come from?
I think this is going back to this idea of OPEC, that, you know, when you looked at non-OPEC supply, so let's say demand actually was accelerating last year and into this year. So that was not until the crisis, until Hormuz, demand was actually re-strengthening. So we were probably growing demand by, say, 1.3 to 1.6 million barrels a day year over year globally. That's healthy. Yeah. It's weakish relative to, you know, pre-war levels and percentage growth, but like relative to where we had been the prior year, it was an acceleration, and that wasn't the problem. The challenge was that non-OPEC was already growing supply by roughly that amount. You had strong growth out of the United States, out of Canada, out of Guyana, Argentina, and Brazil. Out of those countries, you're probably growing by 1.5 to 1.7 million barrels a day. So that alone was already taking care of supply. On top of that, you had OPEC easing back its cuts, something in the order of 2 to 3 million barrels a day, adding on top of that. And what was the surplus that we saw emerge? Was roughly exactly 2 to 3 million barrels a day. It was exactly OPEC's oil that was pushing back onto the market. Now, why was OPEC doing that? And the reason was that they had artificially held up the price of oil for years. Coming out of COVID, they began recutting production. So they basically returned all of their COVID cuts in through the end of 2022. And then there was Russia's invasion and everything else. By the end of that year, though, the oil market, contrary to expectations, was weakening again. Pretty notably. And it was largely because of China's COVID zero policy. They cut back a lot of demand, so that weakened the market. OPEC reacted by cutting back another 2 million barrels a day at the end of 2022. Then they cut back again in the spring of 2023, and again the summer of 2023, and then again the winter, basically into the beginning of 2024. They cut back over 6 million barrels a day of supply between the end of 2022 and the beginning of 2024. That's a lot of supply. That is 6 million barrels a day relative to 9 to 10 that they did during the peak of COVID. This was a huge cut. And even then, you had the oil market failing to balance and continued in modest surplus and was still weakening. So they, over time, were like, we're throwing in a towel. This is unsustainable. We're not going to keep ceding market share to non-OPEC members. Because the whole point was that this was supposed to be a temporary weakness, and then we were going to come back. That temporary weakness never came. And I honestly fault OPEC strategy on this. I think that they created the conditions for the weak market that we were just about to face before Hormuz. I think that was a strategic mistake, and I think they believed too much of the commentary around U.S. shale growth peaking out immediately and contracting quickly. I don't think they were. I don't think they were. I think they had abnormally high demand expectations. They had a bunch of reasons. They thought that there was going to be a temporary, relief to the market, temporary support to the market, and then they would go and do whatever else afterwards. Instead, they ended up in this multi-year slog where they kept cutting back production, and then as a consequence of this, like this is part of the reason why members like the United Arab Emirates left OPEC. Was they were like, this is not in our interest anymore. This is a, this we're trying to do too much. OPEC used to have a much softer hand with the market than they do now. Or at least up until Hormuz, because now Hormuz has kind of neutered the entire organization. But in general, that's what was happening. So when we talk about the weakness last year, I would actually agree that I think that oil was probably mispriced a little bit last year, but I would say in the other direction. I think if anything, the
Got
price
it.
should have been lower.
Got
Because
it.
I saw heavy builds already occurring, and over the balance of the next 18 months, say, 2026 and the first half of 2027, all indications that we're going to keep building massive amounts of stocks. So if it wasn't for Hormuz has actually done a great service to the market balancing itself. It basically
Wow.
wiped away a slate of surplus in one big boom.
Got it.
But now it's this question of like, okay, now we had that surplus and it's gone. Now we're in this
Gone.
situation of like, okay, now what? And if we go
Right.
longer here, then we start cutting to the bone on stocks. This is no longer surplus stocks. This is necessary stocks. And that's when things can get very spiky. Now we can still avoid the apocalypse here. You could still have more US and Chinese and Japanese SPR releases. SPRs would tame some of this price spike. But you also need to replenish those at the end of the day. And you're
Right.
seeing more and more countries looking to replenish their SPRs on the other side of this. I think all that together, I am now very bullish on the oil price for the exact same reasons I was very, very bearish on
So
the oil price in January.
it's mostly on then just reserves and inventory, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
We were drawing, according to my data I published just a little bit earlier this week for March, which is we're still working off lag data here, but in March alone, before the peak of the supply hit was even manifest in the market, we were drawing something like, 5 to 6 million barrels a day in global stocks. That is the fastest pace already. That is relative to a deficit in the market of a relatively similar volume. So I think that this will, and that gets worse in April, and then theoretically begins to stabilize in May at a crazy rate, but the accumulated losses continue to tick higher. And that's where we get to this, you know, billion barrels of lost supply. That's already baked into the market at this stage. We, you know, now this year, we are likely looking, ballpark, we will, you know, relative to what we expected to have produced out of the Middle East this year, you know, in February, we will now produce roughly at least at this stage. And that's if we open like next week, we'll produce 1.5 billion barrels fewer, less supply in the market than we would have expected.
That is huge. Okay. And I was basing my thesis on the oil was mispriced on the downside, meaning that I thought it should be higher. It was really based on sentiment, just investor sentiment. It wasn't based on, just so everybody knows, it was based on, yeah, it was based on that just because it was so negative. There's such a negative outlook. But what you're telling me is that the data says that there's a shortfall right now in reserves.
Yes.
Right now.
Yeah. We're two things, right? We are drawing, because both things are important. The pace at which we're drawing down reserves is important. That's effectively the daily deficit in the market.
Right.
And then there's the level of reserves, which is kind of your thermometer on how tight the market is. So we are drawing down stocks at record pace. Now, again, they started the year high.
Right.
So we have gap, we have buffer to go down. But again, the line is steeper than it's ever been in history. So we are drawing down at a crazy fast rate, and we're going to need to. I mean, even at 5 million barrels a day, that's 150 million barrels of stock draw every month. Yep. And that's what we see, right? And I think that is on top of, that's on top of what we believe is being actually lost by in the market, which is upwards of 400 plus million barrels every month of unproduced supply.
These numbers are staggering.
This is the thing, right? It's like, I would say I am generally a non-alarmist. People would honestly paint me as a perma bear in the market. Right. People didn't like me before this.
Yeah, yeah.
People thought I was bearish.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm familiar with the fact that people didn't like you, Rory. But I think that
right though. That's why I was a fan. And
well, thank you. Yeah. But I think this is the thing, is that those same reasons that I was like stubbornly bearish when everyone wanted me to be bullish. Now right. I'm bullish, and people are like, well, Rory, the price is not really cooperating with your thesis. I'm like, well, that's fine. I agree. That's weird. No doubt.
Yeah.
I've been wrong on the price relationship. That, I think, is manifest in the market. Doesn't change the fact that we're drawing down physical volumes at record rates. So it's going to be really funny. There's always this, like, people are like, oh, well, the fundamentals will win out. I agree.
Right.
The fundamentals always win out. It's, you know, 3 months ago, the fundamentals were insanely bearish. And now they're more bullish than they have been at any point in my career to date.
Okay, so we have this drawdown of both reserves and production. Where's it? This sounds like we got a bunch of puppet masters here, but I want to ask the question anyways. Where is that going to come from? How are they going to make that up? Does it sound like oil can just like turn on a faucet, right? Or it's not like Russia or the U.S.
And yeah. So the answer is it won't really come from anywhere except from storage. You know, you're gonna keep drawing down storage at crazy fast rates, and that, I think, you know, eventually that runs out. Eventually, stocks fall to a level that scares the market to a degree that they start bidding higher and higher and higher prices. And then we get ourselves back onto that price trajectory we were in through March, where we were ripping higher to like 120 in the span of a week or two. That, I think, right now, people are calm again. People are chill. I think unnaturally chill, but they're chill. And I think that will eventually stop being true if this persists. If Hormuz opened today, could we avoid the craziest oil market in history in terms of price?
Yes.
Yes, probably we could. It does not seem like it's opening today.
Right.
And I think that, and even if it did open today, that's the other thing. Relative to my, you know, even if we ended up in the same exact supply-demand relationship or dynamic that we had pre-war, the one I was talking about is really, really bearish, we would be re-entering that market with more than a billion barrels fewer stocks in the system. So that basically right. buys us 2 years of, you know, basically, if you think about it, right, if you think about a 2 million barrel a day surplus for a year, that's like what, like 700 million barrels. We're talking about 1.5 billion barrels. We're talking about, you would need a surplus market of 2 million barrels a day for 2 years to unwind the supply shock that has already kind of been baked into the market. And it keeps getting worse. So I do think that this is one of these things that you can have a moment. Like, again, we can avoid the crazy, crazy high prices, right? I think that there's a way that you can do that even if you ended today. But what that does is it tightens the market along every single piece of it durably for at least a year forward, even if we resume that kind of bearish trajectory. So I think that's the kind of situation that I just think is changed fundamentally. And I think that is broadly being still reflected in the market to a degree, even though the market is still pricing a lower probability of the true kind of cataclysm of, you know, a $200 price realization. And I should note, feel like you were so far off on $200. And yes, prompt futures for Brent capped out at like 120. But dated Brent, the physical benchmark in the North Sea on April 7th, the day that the ceasefire was signed or announced, hit over $144 a barrel. And that was an all-time nominal high for dated Brent. And on top of that, you had record physical premia charge on top of that. You had 20, 25 bucks a barrel premium on top of that for actual point delivery. So you already had people paying in early April upwards of 170 bucks per delivered barrel in the North Sea of physical crude. That has come off a lot because, again, I think that the psychology of the ceasefire and the fact that we need to stop worrying at least immediately about the prospect of like oil wells being bombed and we could just go back to this like ticking clock of Hormuz, that took some of the initial panic out of the market. But that's what it will look like if this continues.
Okay, so we had the war. Let's assume the war is over. Straits of Hormuz has been nominally opened up. I'll just say that at, let's say, between 50 and 60% capacity for the foreseeable future. What does that all look like again now? Because, and I say this, and this is more of a statement. It seems like we got high oil prices. What you're saying, it doesn't really matter if it's opened up nominally or just the floodgates are open up. We're going to have draws on inventory, correct? That's what you're saying.
Yeah. So let's assume that it opens up.
We're going to have draws.
Yeah. Because I think it's important. I think, and then unfortunately, I do need to.
Not draws on inventory.
Yeah. I do need to head out after this. But I do think that like it's important to understand the logistics of what comes next. Because yes. I think that everyone's focused on
that's the
ship
question.
Transits. And I think that that's fair. Right now, you have about just shy of 200 million barrels of oil on ships in the Gulf. That is now effectively a strategic stock of oil that Iran controls.
Okay.
If you get two, you know, that was a day or two ago, you had two VLCs transit. People are like, well, that's 4 million barrels. That's a good rate. And it's fine. But it doesn't change our fundamental challenge, which is that you have a bunch of shut-in production. So yes, you got 2 million, or you got 4 million barrels out of the strategic stock. But what's really going to be needed to restart the system and to get us out of our hole is not just exits, but a full resumption of traffic and entries back into Hormuz.
Yes,
so that you can begin emptying inventories in base, like in the Middle East, and restarting wells. Until that happens, all we're doing is we're like transits right now from Hormuz do not restart oil. They're just shifting one stockpile to another stockpile. So I think that is the important truth to follow right now. So after Hormuz reopens, you exit ships first, then you're going to get new ships in. Maybe eventually everyone's going to be really eager to leave. People are not going to be really eager to jump back into Hormuz at any point. I mean, I wouldn't. And then I think after that, then you can start restarting. But then it's going to take time to get tankers in because they've gone and done other things. It's going to take time to restart the wells. It's going to take a month plus to refill the normal path of oil on water. All of this means that we will still be feeling this, even if this started again today, even if you'd sign the deal and you reopen today, we would still be feeling this by the end of August, easily in the physical market. Easily. There's no way that it can be healed faster than that.
Yep. Got it. Okay. Well said. And that's really the answer. That was really the answer to the question I was looking for. Well, last I want to know is take me on the other side of all of this mess. Okay. And maybe you haven't worked this out. And I say that with all due respect to you, because there's so much going on right now, but walk me through the other side of this mess. Is like, you got the North Sea. Is that collapsing in production? You got Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. That's significantly declining. Correct me if I'm wrong, declining in production. You have the, shale in Western Canada. That's not like it was 10 years ago. So walk me through that. Is this just, where are we going to get more oil in 5 to 10 years? I guess is my point, my question.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on your price level, right? I think at this price level, shale's going to grow, right? I think if you were at $60, as we were prior to the war, I think that shale's days of heady growth were behind it. I think that at $60, shale wasn't growing gangbusters anymore. But it was never a geologic. Peak. It was an economic peak.
Yeah.
It was maxing production at that price level. At $100. They're going to reaccelerate growth. Oh, guaranteed. Same in Canada. Same across everywhere, right? $100 is a very attractive price for most people in the oil market. But I think that even with, going a year out of this, like let's say like 2 years out of this, what does the oil market look like? Well, I still think we have fundamentally the same challenge on our hands, which is that oil demand globally is slowing for a whole bunch of reasons. Slower growth, electrification penetration, all these things. So that, I think, is this long-term kind of drag. But on the other side, you have relatively new and prolific basins that have popped up and are growing quickly. Guyana, Argentina, Brazil. You're going to have U.S. growth still. And Canada's probably going to grow at, 75 to 200,000 barrels a day every year as well. So all of that, that's a lot of just structural kind of baseline growth and supply going forward. I think that should be relatively sufficient for the demand that we're seeing. The big question down the road is, and I think this is the thing we can't know yet, is we do not know what a post-war Middle East looks like. And obviously, even at 10%, even if they were able to get production back to 90% of pre-war levels, that's still like 1.5 million barrels a day of supply offline. That's a year of demand growth easy.
Yeah.
So I think all of these things, there's the Middle East is just so big. Even small swings in the potential outcomes mean very different oil markets going forward. And I think that's going to be the thing. Like, is this the last time we see Hormuz closed, or is this a thing that happens every couple of years now? All of these mean very fundamentally different things for the oil market and I think steady state pricing going forward.
Got it. Okay. What's one advice you can give, piece of advice you can give to myself or investors that are looking to participate in this space? Just one thing to consider, one thing to look at. What's your answer?
I think if you're looking to participate and kind of contribute in the oil space broadly, I think it's really helpful to try and build a global balance. I think, go to the EIA or the IEA or whatever, look at their data sets, look at how they're constructed, play around with them. I think that a lot of people come to this space and they'll naturally gravitate towards fundamentally driven headlines or analysts saying very punchy things. Like $200 oil, who would ever say that? But I think, in that kind of second, people will, you get drawn to the conclusion, but you don't always appreciate the process. And I think that the only way you can really appreciate what goes into building an oil market balance is doing it, because there's about 100 different variables you can toggle at various points. And I think it's important to understand just how much you can swing your view with very small changes in your treatment. But I think that's very, very helpful. I think that's, if I was to give anyone people looking to invest in oil and gas equities, just build a model of balances and play around with it. And I think try and map that to what you're seeing people saying. Because I think that's the only way. That's how I learned to do it. And I think it's been a very useful framework for following the market over the past decade plus now.
Yeah. And to my comment, I think you've been remarkably bright, actually, all things considered. And that's what I appreciate about you is you're very data driven, very, very data driven.
Well, thank you, Andy.
You're very welcome. Rory, if people want to do business with you, if they want to read more about you, if they want to be in touch with you, how do they do that? Where do you want people to go? How do you direct them?
Yeah, so you can follow me at on Twitter or X at Rory_Johnston. You can and you can follow all of my professional work at commoditycontext.com. We've got a weekly report every Friday. We've got a bunch of thematic research that's right now been, unsurprisingly, all about the Iran war and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And then we also have 3 monthly data decks where basically I share all of my balances that I build and maintain. That again, I'm doing this and continue to refine these every month as well, just like all of you, I think, should be as well. So, you know, join me on that journey and try and figure out how this market works.
Yeah, big fan. Rory, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I'll have you on anytime, but thank you so much for coming on, and yeah, we'll do it again there pretty soon.
All right. Have a great day, Andy.
Take care.